This season of the Future Great City podcast is sponsored by Red Brick Realty, a new full-service boutique brokerage firm focused on helping you buy and sell residential, commercial, and investment properties. Tell Red Brick you heard about them here on the Future Great City podcast, and you'll receive $500 off buying or selling a home, apartment building, or commercial property. You can reach Scott Sturdivant at 314-420-9491 or Scott at redbrickstl.com. This is the Future Great City podcast from nextstl.com. Today on the Future Great City podcast, we are joined by the president of the Board of Aldermen for the city of St. Louis, Lewis Reed. He's run for mayor before, made it official in August, not too long ago, that you'll be running again starting this fall for the election next March for the Democratic primary, which is in effect the election in the city.
Exactly, in the city.
So, So let's start there. Did you have any hesitation jumping in again? You've been through this process once. It was virtually you and Mayor Slay running against each other last time. There wasn't really a crowded field, and it looks like it's going to be a little different this time around.
Yes. No, I didn't have any hesitation of jumping in. Alex, as you know, and we've talked before, you know, I was a small business owner and really wanted to work to make a difference in people's lives in the city. And coming into it, I had, kind of like a babe in the woods, right? You think, okay, I'm gonna change all this stuff in one term, and then I'm gonna retire and going back into private business. You come in and find out it's a lot more complex, and it's a much heavier lift than you would ever imagine, right? And that's why I look at a lot of the younger people coming in just like I did back then, and really wanting to make a difference. And you can make a difference, I'm thoroughly convinced. But really, truly understanding the balance of power and how things operate within city government, within this particular city government, because it's not just what the org chart says, right? Because you have to factor the politics and all kinds of other things into it to see how you can move some of these big things. And the way to do it is from room 200, is from the mayor's office. That's why, for sure, I didn't have any hesitation at all.
And you were a two-term alderman from the 6th Ward, correct?
Yes.
And then you're in the middle of your third, not in the middle, but in the third term of your role as president of Board of Aldermen, correct?
Yes.
And so from your view, I mean, when I get frustrated about a lot of things that happen in the city, and I feel like it's just a moving target. And I feel like that's the system has been made so no one's responsible for things, right? And
so,
I've gone to the mayor's office and said, hey, what about this? Here's this idea. And it's always like, well, if you can go convince these people or get the alderman on board, and I'll go to alderman and they'll be like, oh, that's really the mayor's deal, We're dealing with that with subsidies right now, right? With mm-hmm. the TIF and tax abatement and things like that. And aldermen that I like and respect will say, look, it's not up to us. That's SLDC. They could change it tomorrow. It's up to the mayor. He has to do it. And you talk to people in that realm, and they say, "Well, this is what the aldermen want." So how do you get through that stuff? You've seen it from both sides, right?
No, you're exactly right, and that's a perfect example. The onus is on both, right? It isn't one in isolation. In that particular case, it's both. It takes something on the alderman's part, so that when they're approached by developers or homeowners or whatever, right, and says, "Okay, I need a 10-year tax abatement." To first pause and push back and say, really, do you need a 10-year tax abatement?
Right, know what questions to ask, have some kind of process in place.
Yeah, some kind of process in place. But if you take that and reduce that instantly to a board bill and pass it, everybody's going to say, okay, absolutely, mm-hmm. I need a 10-year tax abatement. I can't live with anything less, right? Mm-hmm. So a few years ago, we began a policy at the Board of Aldermen to try to get aldermen to push back and to get people to a 5-year tax abatement, right? And it takes, because you're dealing with all these individuals, right, that have ideas and things of their own and the way they like to move things, and not one solution fits everything. There are parts of the city, both north and south, but more on the north side that could benefit and would really need a 10-year tax abatement. And there are parts of the city, both north and south, mainly on the south side, that 10-year tax abatement is borderline ridiculous now, right? So, and that same thing with other development incentives. You look at development incentives as a whole, and what's, you know, the rebuilding that's happened across the city of St. Louis, whether it's Lafayette Square, Washington Avenue, the downtown business district, you know, parts of Central West End, those areas that have benefited hugely from incentives, right? And now there's more pressure being put on to just do a wholesale elimination of those, right? And certainly I think that we need we need to really take a hard look at what we're incentivizing and why and what benefit those incentives are going to bring to the residents of the city.
And that seems to be the hole in this whole plan is that, you know, my take is that if you look at these incentives, we don't even know if they're effective because we're not measuring them against anything.
Exactly. No. Right? So, no, you're okay.
No, so if somebody comes up and says, our policy is to bring a Whole Foods to the Central West End because A, B, and C, people can agree or disagree with that policy,
yeah,
but then incentivize it to make that policy a reality, right?
No, you're exactly right. But, you know, the whole thing, and thank you for bringing up measuring, because that's like one of the key things. We're not measuring on the side to see, okay, what are the benefits of it? And, you know, there are data models that exist out there, right? And we're working on one now that would give us more information about what we're about to do. And here's an example. Would it help us or hurt us to have a 5% tax increase on goods and services in the city of St. Louis? I can tell you what my gut reaction is. You can tell me what your gut reaction is, and people all across the city could do that. But at the end of the day, what we would need is some good hard facts, a model to plug that into and say, okay, this is the cause and effect of that, right? And we could achieve that same thing by doing X, Y, or Z, right? But that's not the approach now. The approach is more of a, you know, kind of gut reaction. And that's what has led us to what we see here today. To change that has to happen from the mayor's office, from room 200, because it has to do with policies. It has to do with the development agency and the way it operates and what it requires before moving things.
Right. And we hear a lot that the city is basically poor and not in a bad way, but just like they're not able to do proactive development because these offices aren't funded. SLDC doesn't have the funding they need. LRA doesn't have the funding it needs. But it strikes me that we can find money when we want to, right?
Yeah.
We can mortgage our own city buildings when we want to.
We can
do all these things, right? And we passed a huge tax increase in the city for the arch grounds, for example, and voters did that.
Yeah.
But that's $120 million, I think, just from the city over 20 years. Like,
yes.
we're not poor. We do the things we want to do.
Yeah.
So as mayor, how do you actually change that? Do you go? I honestly don't know the process. I mean, your SLDC and other places report to you. So do you just, you go to them and you start changing policy. You start saying, here's how we're going to do things. Because ultimately, the challenge seems to be that the current mayor hasn't wanted to pick fights with aldermen, right? And so
yes.
No one wants to put a foot down and say, listen, this is not right. We're going to change it because he's going to have, you know, I don't know, 8 people, 11 people, 14 people mad at him at least, right? And so then the coalition start to break down on other things you want to get done. So how do you,
in any of these things you do, you're going to be short-term pain and for some long-term gain, right? Which is why it's important to measure and understand and understand clearly what you're changing.
Let me ask you this. Some people tell me that like what St. Louis really needs is a one-term mayor. You know what I mean? To get in, make some of these changes and piss people off if it pisses people off. And if you're a good one-term mayor, all of a sudden you find yourself as a 2- and 3-term mayor, maybe. Would you be willing to be a one-term mayor if you were able to fix some of these things?
Look, right. Absolutely. Because here's some of the things truly, to be honest with you, Alex, to get to where we need to be in terms of, you know, having a true impact on public safety in the city, homelessness in the city, setting the city on a development path that's going to, integrate some of its natural assets, right, and marketing those things out to the rest of the world. Those things, it's easy to sit here and say that, but to actually do it is a very, very heavy lift. It's a lift that I'm prepared to do because that's the whole reason I've dedicated all this time in my life to be able to make those changes. And now after being in office and working in city government and working to make some of these changes over time, And seeing some of the roadblocks and the subtleties and how things are blocked and how we get to the developments we get to. For example, you know, when you look at how new businesses land in the city of St. Louis, isn't really not by the city of St. Louis going out marketing, recruiting, and really working within these major corporations and working to have a relationship so we know if Google is planning a major move and we are on the forefront of it and we're working with Google to assure that we're the choice, right? We wait until those things land at our doorstep, right? And then when they land at our doorstep, we say, okay, maybe we should do something about that, right? But the thing is, they're not landing at your doorstep anymore. This is a more connected world than it ever has been. And if we're not out, if we haven't remade ourselves and begin to leverage modern technology and begin to leverage, the natural assets of the city in the appropriate way, we're going to continue down the same road. Now, we've been lucky to make progress along the way, right? And we have made some progress along the way, but we can do so much better by changing some of the ways we operate, but it's not going to be without some pain.
Well, and it very much seems like a lot of our success, and we talk about Cortex a lot, and outside of St. Louis, I think Cortex is known as the successful, redevelopment in St. Louis. I mean, people know Cortex far and wide, and certainly in the business development community and tech community and medical community. But what strikes me about that process is I know government had a role in it. The city government had a role in it. But it was really abdicated to everyone else, right? So Washington University does it. Yeah. Other people do it. Wexford does it. And in fact, and I don't mean these as digs on the current mayor, but this is what we're talking about. There was a tweet from him not too long ago that said something like, "It's been amazing to watch Cortex develop." And I just thought, like, that is the most passive attitude towards the biggest development project our city will see. Well, we'll talk about NGA, but this is remaking
this
a neighborhood.
That's real. It's happened.
Yeah, and I hear people, not the mayor, but I hear other people kind of act like Cortex is on autopilot. Yeah. Like, oh, the universities have that figured out. Let's just get out of their way. And I keep thinking, like, man, I feel like, personally, there should be a mayor out there talking about this nonstop. And we can't just assume, like, everybody knows that. It's like 30% developed, maybe. And it's great. It's off to a great start, and it could be something very cool. It's got a long ways to go, though. So.
Yeah, and you look at Cortex, okay? If you're not out there, actively talking about it, promoting it, and really understanding Cortex top to bottom, so you're down there in meetings and you're doing walkthroughs, it's not just showing up for that ribbon cutting and said, thanks, pat them on the back. Great job, guys. I'm out of here, right? It's really getting down and understanding, the business model, understanding what makes Cortex, tick and what else could Cortex benefit from, right? And baking that into everything else you do, right? So when you're out and you're trying to attract new businesses or whatever, or augment some local business, some local small business owners that could use a little help or that may be looking for new locations to do whatever they're doing, the more you know about that asset, the more you're better positioned to help them succeed, but then also help others to succeed.
So we've had some success, especially in the Central Corridor, in terms of just development and dollars and jobs and things like that. But one thing you really keyed in on your announcement to run for mayor is investing in neighborhoods. We're down here on the south side, and I know it's kind of not conventional wisdom, but it's obvious that the north side of St. Louis needs the most investment. That's where the most vacancy and that kind of thing is. I now work at the Dutchtown South Community Corporation. I'm in Dutchtown every day. And it feels very much that this area of the city is at a tipping point. You know, you go further south and Carondelet Park and the area on there is still very solid, very nice. But it's not the case really when we're talking about the area around Marquette Park, Gravelly Park. So I'm personally now interested in that neighborhood, but you can speak to a larger issue. How do we invest in neighborhoods? Whether it's small businesses or addressing vacancy or safety, what does that mean when you say, I'm going to be a mayor that invests in neighborhoods?
Well, first thing that means is that I'm going to be a mayor that engages in the neighborhood itself and the community itself, far more than what we've seen in the past. I think that it is a huge asset that we have not leveraged, just the brain power, the talent, and everything else within the neighborhoods across the city. And Alex, you know this, you can do it development two ways. You can do it to a neighborhood or a community, or with a neighborhood and a community. And when you move toward doing it with the neighborhood and the community, and I think that that's where we had a lot of our success over in the Sixth Ward, because we worked very, very closely with the community on the developments so that there was community buy-in, right? There were master plans backing it all up, right? And then we empowered the community and made them part of the forward progress of those developments. And I think that that's an important component. The other thing is, the first stop for developers when they're coming in the city of St. Louis, especially if they're out-of-town developers, is the mayor's office, right? Naturally, you go to any major city, if you just think about that, where are you going to stop? You're going to stop at the mayor's office. And then from there, you work your way down to the development agencies, and ultimately, you work your way over to the legislative branch, over to us. If you're a local developer that has been through that process, a lot of times one of your first stops may be the legislative branch. That mayor's office gets it, whether you are local or whether you are a new developer looking to possibly do something in the city. So where that developer lands, how that developer decides to invest in our city, and what that developer's expectation is, right, in terms of dealing with the city, comes from that very first engagement. So that's what a developer will get the idea of, okay, I'll be able to do this development, put very little of my money in, and leverage everything that the city has. Or, and you guess what? My development, I'm going to do downtown because it lowers my risk, right? We have to first understand what assets we have in each and every neighborhood, what is the layout of those neighborhoods, so are they great walkable communities? When we connect multiple neighborhoods together, what does that look like, right? And how do we market that? And what age groups are we targeting in terms of home ownership and getting them to live there, right? And raise families there and making a life there, right? And how are we coordinating the resources, right? How are we working to make sure that they have access to grocery stores and everything else? And how are we going to bridge the gap between what the developer and the new prospective business needs and what they will look at when they drop the pen and draw the quarter mile circle, half mile circle, and look at everything from education to public safety and all these things. How are we, as a city, going to position the city to begin to answer those things and still drive that development to a place where it benefits everyone? Whether you live on the south side, whether you live on the north side, the city of St. Louis, whether you live in the county, whether you live in Joplin, everybody benefits from the city investing in areas that have seen massive underinvestment, whether that's on the north side or south side. But we will all benefit from that. So it's important that we invest in
those. Are there some processes that the city's gone through recently or some neighborhoods or some examples of what you see as kind of model development, like how this should be done?
Well, when you look at, what we did in Lafayette Square, right? And when we did that, nowadays you look at TIFs and you look at how they've been, just used on everything, including, West County Mall, right? And if you can show me
the boulevard, too.
Yeah. If you can show me where West County Mall required a TIF to be able to be built, I would like to see how they made those numbers work. But Lafayette Square, back when I became an alderman in Lafayette Square, and there was a junkyard right where you had the beautiful fountain and plaza and everything. The 1111 Mississippi, the restaurant, that was a vacant and abandoned building, and the condo towers behind it had collapsed three floors into itself, right?
And that wasn't really all that long ago. I mean, I remember that being empty. I've been in town 12 years, and so there's an idea that people restored Lafayette Square in the 70s or something. But so there, people started it, and people were buying homes and doing it themselves, but Lafayette Square has not been what it is today for all that long.
Oh, not that long. Eaton Publishing Building, right there at the corner of Shoto and Mississippi, right? Mm-hmm. When you were actually a block down, that building completely had been vacant for so many years you couldn't even remember, right? The Eads building, where his office was, collapsed. I mean, the whole back wall was torn out. That's what that neighborhood and community looked like, like you said, not that long ago. Here's the steps that we took to take it from where it was back then to where it is now. Number one, we took a hard stand on saving these buildings that had historic significance. So the 1111 Mississippi, where that restaurant is, they were going to mow down that building and that tower to make a parking lot. We said no. We had a major fight with the administration at that time, and I partnered with the neighborhood and community there, and we were able to stop them from doing that, and that's why you have that asset there now. You look at, the way Park Avenue and what it looks around the park, that came from a plan called the urban plan, right? And when I partnered with the neighborhood to put together the urban plan, the next thing I did to codify it so that the city was on the hook for the urban plan was I passed it into law,
right?
Opposed to just having the neighborhood take up the plan and it sit on the shelf.
Right.
And then here's the final piece, the hook that kind of brought it all together, right? So back then, back in those days, when developers would come to get TIFs, they would get a TIF on their building, right? And the city would invest in that through that TIF over time. But the TIF allows you to draw the area, right? It's not just the building, the area, which is common now, right? But back then, it wasn't common. And so I said, well, if we continue to just TIF or do tax abatement on these one-off structures, we still haven't created an environment where a business can survive and an environment where the community at large would benefit from, right? So once we got the urban plan put together, I passed the neighborhood TIF, and it took a long time to pass that neighborhood TIF because a number of aldermen were diametrically opposed to it because they said, well, this money will go to the community to implement the urban plan, that whole street urban plan. But that money should go to the developer. And I said, why? Mm-hmm. Why, right? The developer is going to benefit from having an environment that is stable, that they can then open their business in and thrive in. That was the idea. So we passed that neighborhood TIF. We empowered the neighborhood with the TIF. So we put the neighborhood in charge of the TIF, mm-hmm. opposed to a developer, and then buckled that together with the urban plan, changed that neighborhood.
So, and this is still a work in progress. I mean, there's still infill happening, even facing the park. I mean, you go a couple
Absolutely.
Blocks off and there's still a need for more development. And so what strikes me, and I think it's really fascinating to listen through this process, because it's in one view, it can be seen as kind of the best of city development, right? And an alderman has some type of vision, some type of plan, and says, we're going to codify this. We're not just spending money on a plan that sits on a shelf. And Lafayette Square and that neighborhood has been a success in many ways because of this process. It's also a shame that that's the process, right? And
yes,
so you go alder person by alder person, and frankly, some people have a vision, some don't. Some are pressured to pave alleys, some are pressured to create development plans, right?
Yeah.
How do we get away from that? How do we get away from 28 different development plans across our city?
You know, the same thing that we did in Lafayette Square and Washington Avenue, some of these other places, that could be done also from the mayor's office. But the mayor has to begin to approach these things in a much different way than we've approached them. You know, like I talked about, how do we get new businesses in the city? Well, they just show up. And then we say, okay, let's block and tackle. Let's try to work with it. We have an opportunity here. There's an opportunity knocking on the door. Let's go get it, opposed to going chasing it down. So I think we have to, you know, getting back to what you asked earlier that led to the Lafayette Square discussion about neighborhoods and how do we begin to develop in those neighborhoods is understanding what each and every neighborhood needs and what makes up that neighborhood and how we begin to develop with that neighborhood and that community to bring out its assets to the benefit of the entire city.
Is it a matter of resources a lot of times? Is it a matter of making sure, is the mayor's office able to, you know, provide more funding, identify more funding, go find more funding or something like that? Because there are certainly wards that, you know, every ward has a small pool of money, but they are making the decision, do we pave an alley? Do we plant trees? What do we do with it? So it strikes me as though it's never going to happen if it's left up to each individual alderman to decide what to do with it.
I agree. There absolutely has to be some leadership there. There has to be some you know, an overarching plan and a lot of data being gathered and a lot of groundwork being laid to understand these neighborhoods.
Provide some of the basic input and data to work from. So
and the question you asked about you know, where does the money come? Where does the money and resources come from? You look at, like, in Lafayette Square, it wasn't there, right? But we took a look at all the different ways that we could fund that plan and not just have a plan. So I think we have to push the envelope. I think we have to look at the different ways we can fund it. I think that we have opportunities. Immense opportunities across the city. I think we have businesses, local nonprofits, and for-profit corporations that would gladly engage and help everywhere they could. I think that, in terms of federal funding, I think we need to get more active on federal funding. I think our transportation corridors and how we set those up are going to make a big difference in the growth and development of some of our areas. And I think we need to leverage all those things.
And so at DSCC, at Dutchtown South, we're working with RISE, Lutheran Development Group, and some other people, Incarnate Word Foundation, to do a development plan. It sounds a lot like what happened in Lafayette Square. So, and it has a geographic boundary that doesn't include everything that our community corporation covers, but we are also aiming to get it codified. Like, it's going to go into a bill. It's
perfect.
Going to be, the city will have to reply or, you know, respond to it. And hopefully we're doing that the right way. But let me ask you this real quick. Is it a positive thing that we're moving from 28 aldermen and 28 wards to 14?
Here's what I say.
Does that simplify development? Does it simplify, like, you know, when a developer wants to come to the city, they don't have to look at 28 places and say, okay, I have to go talk to Lewis Reed. I have to go talk to Sam Moore. I have to talk to whoever, you know?
Yeah. From sitting through all the discussions and everything related to this, a number of aldermen said, okay, $30,000 a year and having to work all these hours, 7 days a week, you know, I'm sorry, you know, we need a higher pay, right? So that's what a number of all, that was part of the argument that kind of
went. It's a tough job because a lot of times you have to treat it like a full-time job, but then, everyone has to work another job or have other income from their family or something. I mean, it's difficult.
Yeah, it's a part-time job that requires full-time, right? So that was the argument coming from part of the aldermen. And then some of the other aldermen that had been in there for a long time, ready to retire, they wanted their hallmark to be, okay, the reduction in the Board of Aldermen. So that was the competing interest, right? So the idea... And here's where the problem comes in and rub. The idea is once the Board of Aldermen is cut in half, that the remaining aldermen would see salary double.
Get themselves a raise.
Right. So now here's the problem.
Works, right?
It works in their favor, but it does not work in interest of what you and others would hope to have achieved, and that's a system that works better with more resources, allocations, and things of that nature. That would not have changed.
As
a matter of fact, that could actually get worse, right? Mm-hmm. Because now you're sitting there with even less resources, right? A guy or a girl, you know, whether you're an alderman or an alderwoman, right? When you're out there now, and you're not returning calls,
right,
and you have half the area,
you have
twice as many people, no more resources, because every dime that you could have used to create more resources has gone into additional pay for you. So there will have to be a change in that. I think that either the ones that would be left would have to understand that you're not going to double your salary, mm-hmm. right? Because we need a system that's going to operate more efficiently, right? And then the powers of that alder person have grown, you know, grown. The district has grown twice. I'd say the powers of that alderman now have grown 5, 6, 7, 8 times, because now instead of them impacting just that one area, you now have a much broader impact. But guess what? It takes a whole lot more votes to get you unseated, right? And it takes a lot more money to run an effective campaign if you're going to go unseat one of these powerhouses, right? Because right now, I think it's an easier shot if grassroots, you need 900 votes or something like this.
Yeah.
But what strikes me is that's the both sides of it. And so it's a little more complex, and it's going to take some time.
So I'm hearing it could be a good thing, but we'll see.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough. But what strikes me is, again, it's another issue in the city that no one brought. I saw no one involved in this process brought evidence to the table. I didn't hear another city mentioned. You know, I heard the pushback being, I'm going to have twice as many constituents to call. You know, I give my cell phone number out to everyone. Now I've got 30,000 people with my cell phone number. And I'm thinking, you know, Why is that a problem? Maybe that's an issue. But, yeah. You know, and I think literally someone said, you know, when a tree falls down in my ward, they can call me and I call forestry. And it's like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, trees fall down in Indianapolis and Cincinnati and they get picked up, I think.
Exactly.
I'm sure. I don't know how it works, but we're missing, I don't know, it's professional services where people should call directly. Like, the aldermen, I think, they hate it, but they love it, being in the middle of this process. And so something has to change.
The aldermen, truly, the Board of Aldermen, they're legislators, right? Mm-hmm. But they're service providers because they're the closest contact to government that people have, right?
So people enjoy that.
But here's the thing. We look at some things like if a constituent turns in a request because a tree has fallen, right? Mm-hmm. And then 2-3 weeks later, that tree is still there, right? So then they have to call the alderman, and then the alderman calls, and then the tree is magically removed. That's a problem.
Yes.
Because what that shows is that something within the system, something within the department or whatever, isn't working right, mm-hmm. right? That's what that shows. And and I think part of what is at play here is that we've gotten into the system where everybody calls to get, you know, all their favors taken care of, right? So these favors are out there clogging up the top end of the system, so that if you are an average constituent who pay taxes in the city, who is expecting the department to work on your behalf, right? And the department is staffed, and you can't blame the workers, you can't blame the department, because they're responding to what they're receiving, mm-hmm. right? Yours get lost in the woods, but then all these other special requests, which may not be as critical as yours, are sitting on the top of the heap just because of who's called. So that whole culture, we need to begin to address that whole culture and change that whole culture to see a difference in that. Mm-hmm. And what we'll see is the department being able to operate more efficiently and effective, because now the decision making is being made at that department level, opposed to
deferring to the aldermen and allowing them to jump the line sometimes.
Yes.
Would it make sense for the city to have at-large aldermen? One of the things, and I've beat this drum for a while, is that, you know, these individual aldermen aren't responsible for a citywide vision. So whether that's, Gravois, you know, figuring out, it goes through 7 wards, right? So MoDOT comes in with a plan to repave it, and everyone kind of says, okay, it's just a sliver of my ward, right?
Yeah.
So no one's responsible for an overall vision. And I think that's part of the reason you don't see a push from the aldermen for an overall city plan. They want things for their ward. You know, they need those 900 votes or whatever it is to get elected. That's a long-winded way of a simple question. Would it make sense to have someone responsible for the whole city?
And that's what the president of the Board of Aldermen is. Mm-hmm. You know, technically, when you look at it, you're an at-large.
It's a citywide vote.
By
everyone.
Yeah, and then the beauty of being the president of the Board of Aldermen is that you can operate in a way where you're not obligated to make sure everyone, you know, that at any given time 15 other aldermen are happy with you. Because if you're in that shape, especially in a city like St. Louis, you might as well forget it. You tie your hands, you're done, because because you would be just absolutely shackled and not be able to operate and get things moving. Like for example, when the water department issue came up, when they were going to do at first, the guys came to my office, so I know what the original plan was. The original plan was the city of St. Louis entering into a 45-year agreement with these guys, mm-hmm. essentially, you know, deeding over the water department with them with automatic, you know, 40 some odd year, renewal right. or something right. crazy like that. So that was the original agreement, right? There was a whole lot of aldermen, there was a whole suite of aldermen that they had, the mayor's office had kind of good with that plan and ready to move that plan with the lobbyists and everything. We had worked the room already, right? So when I took the stance and said, no, I'm sorry, that's a bad plan, right? Now, behind the scenes, all heck broke loose, right? Because people were, some of them were saying, hey, what are you doing? Because think about
it. It was all set up to go.
Yeah.
They just assumed everyone would go along with it, I guess.
Yeah, you had the former head of the Democratic Party in the state of Missouri that was part of the deal mm-hmm. on the other side, right? So, but not having to report to or not having to, advocate to 15 of these guys, I was able to say, no, I'm sorry, that's a bad deal for the city. And then we went to the Board of ENA, and I was the only vote against the thing when we walked into the meeting at the Board of ENA. Thank God 100 and some odd people showed up. Mm-hmm. And here's what changed the vote. And people that were in the room that day, they'll tell you. When it was time to vote, the comptroller said, well, how many of you are from the city of St. Louis? Because the idea that was pushed to the members of the Board of Aldermen and everybody else is that all these folks are from the county, so it doesn't matter. So the whole room raised their hands, and the comptroller flipped her vote, and we ended up being able to save it. But it's those types of exchanges that end up benefiting the voters at the end of the day through the independents.
So it strikes me as it would be, I don't know if it's easier is the right word, but more clear cut with, again, the fewer the aldermen, the easier it is, because easier for both sides, maybe, because you're not trying to lobby 28 people or 15, you're trying to lobby, 7 or 8 or something like that. Maybe it saves you time. I don't know.
I don't know if it's
good or bad.
Well, as president of the Board of Aldermen, as mayor, that it is 100% it's much easier to deal with.
Sure.
If I take off that hat and say, okay, as a resident and a taxpayer and a father and someone that understands the way this system works,
it's beneficial at times.
Well, I think it also leaves a much bigger window open to major contributors, major developers to buy off fewer.
Sure. Right? No, and I think that's a big challenge. I think the other positive
is that balance.
The other positive in a way is I think that a lot of our wards struggle to find good candidates. So you have 28 wards, you have 11,000 people in each one. I don't know how many are even eligible to run.
Yeah.
And I'm from a small town of less than that. My hometown was 6,000, and man, finding people to be city manager and stuff was difficult, right?
Yeah.
You have to find people who are not only qualified but interested, and so, you just have this tiny pool, and then, someone like me, for example, who wants to say I wanted to run for alderman. I don't live in the city. People know this.
Yeah.
But what do I do? Do I literally look at a map at 28 and say, where am I going to move my family on the idea that maybe eventually I would like to run for office? And then, oh, by the way, understand I'll never be elected here because it's a third generation alder person who will never be defeated. And so, that's pretty daunting to think you're just kind of pushed out. And it's hard to figure out how to participate in an official capacity if that's the setup.
So. Yeah. And you're right. You're right. That's the other side of it. And I think obviously there's some benefits to be had on that side too. I think campaign finance limits and those things also help. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to have all those things.
And that was just passed, correct? This past week, I think it was a limit of $10,000.
Yes.
Local elections.
Yes, so. And I think that helps, right? Mm-hmm. I think we need to go back and further refine it, and mm-hmm. I think that's everybody that debated it understood that I think we have to go back and further define.
But it's a good start. So you mentioned the Board of Estimate and Apportionment, and in the water, the privatization, where I'm sure someone wouldn't say that, a contract, whatever they were trying to do with our water system, right? That
it was
defeated.
Private. 90
it
years.
Was. Fair enough.
Yeah, I'm not going to use it.
And the company would have owned all the proprietary, anyway.
And then they could, hit us with a rate hike and everything. So it was.
And we would have lost the knowledge to be able to run our own system, and it would have been a challenge. So anyway, so that was defeated in a way because, you know, you need two of three votes. So you have the mayor, you have the comptroller, Darlene Green, and you have the president of the board of aldermen, or the three votes, right? And,
yeah.
And so in that case, you were able to get Green to switch her vote. The other,
well, I wasn't. The community
correct.
Did.
The community. Your leadership? Do you want to take credit for that?
I'll take credit for the fact that I was going to vote against it. And I was. Yes. I thank God that the 200 people showed up.
But the other time this group came up, and I think a lot of people's introduction was with the stadium financing effort for the NFL stadium. And that came through, and there was pressure and an argument that this should have gone to a vote of the public. There was a pretty contentious process, and what ended up happening is, you know, the mayor and then the comptroller staked out their positions very early in the process, which made you, lucky you, the swing vote.
Yeah.
And in the end, I'll let you characterize it, but you voted basically in favor of the financing package the city put together to try to build a new NFL stadium. Can you explain why?
Oh, absolutely.
And also maybe the... Well, I'll let you do that first.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks. Thanks for asking this question, because I think it's an important question. I think about, you know, anybody that really knows me, you know, and even though some of those that don't know me very well, you know, I don't watch a lot of sports, whether it's baseball, whether it's football. I just don't. But I have other hobbies. I'm a data guy, so, you know, I really enjoy that. I look at neighborhood stuff and things of that nature, and that's what I spend my off time doing, right, opposed to watching football and these things. So when that stadium deal came around, and it did not go to a vote, right, and when the mayor and those guys, in my estimation, they laid down on the thing when it went to court, I took a stance against that. I said that, you know what, the people deserve the right to vote, and I think it was wrong the way that whole exchange and how they went around the people on that. I thought that that was wrong. I think that
technically the city challenged. They went to court to quote defend the legislation, saying it required a public vote. But the charge is that the defense was not particularly strong.
The whole argument of adjacent, right?
Yeah, and that's what. Yeah. It, and that's where what the stadium was located and things, and they didn't. Yeah. So, but the judge basically said that yes, it's the city can the city does not have to take it to a public vote. Was the result of the city's challenge?
Yes. You know, that's why I sent the letter to the mayor's office. I asked him, I said, you know what, you need to appeal this immediately and get this thing back in court to give the people a right to vote, right? But once we passed that threshold and we were looking at, okay, now we're stuck with either A, picking up the tab of this empty stadium for a number of years, right? We had just come off of a year with over 170 some odd murders in the city of St. Louis. No real job prospects for a lot of these young, and I'm going to say young men, because the majority of the murders and the people being murdered and dying in the city of St. Louis were all young men, right? And you know, all of that comes from when we see the spikes in crimes that we've seen in the city of St. Louis. A lot of that comes from lack of opportunity, lack of jobs, lack of, you know, and the hopelessness and feeling disconnected from a system that's not working for you, right? And having working to make sure that we had, solid, opportunities out there for women and minority men and women owned businesses. And
as part of the stadium's plan.
Not just as part of everything, and watching how the city, you know, through the executive branch skillfully maneuvers around that stuff, right? When the stadium deal came up, we took a look at it and said, look, if we do nothing, then everybody will say, guess what? We could have saved the Rams and had a stadium deal done, had $1 billion possibly coming to the city of St. Louis, and that board of aldermen laid down and did nothing.
Yeah,
right?
And then you have the construction. You have maybe not just residents, but the construction industry and lots of other people blaming you for that.
Yeah,
right?
Yes. But and then we look at it and said, okay, what's the possibility that the Rams are going to come? Yeah, I didn't know. Right.
It felt like a toss-up. In retrospect, it seems obvious, I guess. But
yeah, but at the time, it said, well, certainly if we didn't do anything, they wouldn't come.
Sure.
But if we did something, we had an opportunity to attract them. We have an opportunity for $1 billion investment. When was the last time the state of Missouri said they're going to put in hundreds of millions of dollars into the city of St. Louis for anything?
What it sounds like you're kind of getting at is again, the way a lot of development happens, is this was set in motion, and when it got, by the time it gets to you and the Board of Aldermen, it's either thumbs up or thumbs down. There's no actual legislating to do. So.
Exactly right. The thing is prepackaged, right? Mm-hmm. But I want to make sure to drive this point home. You look at where the pools of money were coming from. The state of Missouri, the NFL would have had to put in some odd couple hundred million dollars and so on and so forth. But, mm-hmm. you know, majority of the money for that deal was coming in from outside the city. So if it happened, and the state would have given us $300 million, whatever, the more power to them, that would have been great. But how does the local businesses, benefit from that? And not only that, how do we begin to create real sustainable life skills within, our job skills within some of our more affected communities across the city of St. Louis and change the lives of these families? So that's the target that was our target. And the language we put in that bill is the language they had to pick up and then put into NGA. I've worked, all the years I've been in politics, mm-hmm. never, like if you look at the language we put in that bill, had it not been for a football stadium deal that everybody on the other side of this thing absolutely felt like, they had to have, they would have never agreed to that language, right?
But interesting. I don't think I've heard that perspective. I hadn't made the connection between the NGA and the NFL stadium before.
Yeah, and guess what? Now downstream, whether it's NGA or whatever, we now have a precedent for that moving forward. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, you look at the people, my wife was against the stadium, right? Yeah. Right. My cousin, everybody I know, all of my friends, the people I cycle with, right, they're all like, what the heck is the stadium doing? For me, it's not about a stadium. But I look at it and I said, you know what? I don't know how many of these funerals you've attended. I've attended a fair amount of these things. When you look at it, you say, okay, you know what? If you would sit with one of these families that are burying a family member because of things the city could have done to make the environment, to change the environments that would have impacted that family and the family surrounding it in a different way. I mean, that's the whole reason we're here.
I think a lot of the best argument for the stadium was that it was if it had come through as written by the city, it would have been one of the better stadium deals in recent history.
Yes.
I'm not sure that's that's something. It's better than lots of cities and states were offering to do. So in the end, it was not terrible. Anyway, it didn't happen. So they're gone.
Yeah.
NGA is obviously a big deal in the city. Is that, do you have any concerns with it? Or are you simply, it's a big win and we have to manage development around it?
I think that the concerns of it is the implementation phase and what it does and
whether neighborhoods are engaged and what happens. It's a behemoth, right? It's $2 billion probably by the end. They'll overrun their cost.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be bigger.
Good point. They will overrun it.
Yeah.
But, you look at a development like that, and it's great to have it on the board. It's the implementation is the whole, that's the key, right? And whether we have outgrowth from it or it ends up being just on an island, right? So I think we have to really take a good look at, the implementation of it. I think we need to have, high level of stakeholder involvement, not just these meetings where we post it and they say, oh, yeah, we're supposed to have three community meetings. We put it in ads and the Post-Dispatch and we held it. And, okay, how many people showed up? Oh, 15 at each. Okay. Yeah. Well, is that really community engagement? What else have you done to reach out to the community to give them ample opportunity for engagement?
Well, and the promise of that project is it's 100 acres that will never pay taxes, right? And so it wasn't generating a lot of revenue before, and so that's one issue. But then if it doesn't catalyze development around it, and we do this over and over again, right? this is my thing with, you know, downtown in a way where everyone seems overly concerned about Laclede's Landing. And I keep thinking we have the Arch, a $500 million casino, $700 million football stadium, another $400 million at the Arch. And if the Landing isn't doing well with that, there's some other issue, right? It's not just so the NGA is not, you can't plop it down and assume things are going to happen. And it's the benefit will be what happens outside.
You have to have buy-in from the community.
Well, that wraps up our first half of our conversation with mayoral candidate and president of the Board of Aldermen in the city of St. Louis, Lewis Reed. Join us next week for the rest of our conversation.
You can subscribe to this podcast via RSS feed or on iTunes, and can follow the site on Twitter at NextSTL. Thanks for joining us. Be informed, be engaged, be part of what's next. NextSTL.com.